accession number 8736, rule number 40.
Lord Harding, tape 40. Yes, you were explaining about the attacks on the police station, Lord Harding.
Well, this was the beginning of their operations. They started in April 55, and their main target to start with was the police. They attacked police stations in order to demoralise the police and also to get arms and ammunition, of course.
When you actually went to Cyprus at the end of 1955, was the relationship between Makarios and Grievous, was that quite straightforward? Did you realise, for instance, that there was this close tie between them?
Well, it was pretty obvious. There was no proof of it at that time, but it was pretty obvious that certainly after I started having my discussions with Makarios, it was pretty clear. In fact, very clear that the relationship really was that he was the political chief and Grievous was the military chief of the EOKA movement. That became quite clear to me, and that was eventually confirmed, of course, when the Grievous diaries were unearthed and found. And that confirmed that and established it as a fact. And it wasn't firm or definite at that time that was the relationship or connection, but it was pretty obvious.
Looking at the groups in Cypriot society, how important was the communist organisation?
At that stage, I don't think of any great importance. But it became more important because the AKEL, the Greek communist organization, was the most efficient and the best organized of all the political parties in Cyprus. And although they weren't active, I think they certainly weren't active members of the EOKA, but they were not hostile to EOKA. But I think it's very difficult to understand the whole business, really, because the Greeks themselves, by nature, are not violent or people. They're much more peaceful, and they're really like to make a good living. They're business people. They're good farmers. They're good businessmen, and so on. They're not military-minded or given to violence in that way. Except there's a saying that in Cyprus, there are usually three causes for murders: money or women, but most likely of all, water for irrigation, because there's only one natural source of water from underground in Cyprus, or there was, there still is, I think, only one. And so everything depends on both rainfall and conserving the rain for irrigation purposes. And actually, the British administration had done a great deal towards building reservoirs and conserving, and that was continued. And one of my main objects and purposes during my time as government was to build on that and to improve on it and to continue that policy of conserving water for irrigation purposes. But land and water are very, and the two go together, hand in hand, in those countries, in all Middle Eastern countries, it's the same. land and water. So that really is the other problem. But by nature, the Greeks are friendly, hospitable people, actually. And I used to make a point always of visiting as many towns and villages and getting to know the communities as well as I could. And if I went to a mixed village, I would walk down the village street, I would meet the local priest and the local muktar, who was the head Turkish civil, and have a meeting with them in the coffee shop. But they're not, by nature, a violent people, and I think, if looking back on it all, I think a good many of them strongly disapproved of the resort to violence. But they are, and the fact that the ochre had the were able to cash in, or if you like to put it that way, on the support of the bulk of the Greek population, well, the greater part, far and away the greater part of the Greek population, that was partly from sympathy and partly from fear.
How about the Turks? What sort of people were the Turks?
The Turks are much less sophisticated people than the Greeks. They are inside the Turks in Cyprus. Their land, for the most part, is agricultural land. They don't have the best of land, and up till the end of the last century. They were nearly all either landowners or peasants. There was practically no, very, very little middle class, no professional, very few professional classes. That, of course, started to build up under the British administration, because there was training, there were opportunities, there was the civil service, there was the medical profession, there was the legal profession, and so on. And the story is, and I don't know, I can't vouch for it, that when Kemal Atatürk decided to modernize Turkey, to use a general expression, he drew on the professional classes in Cyprus a great deal, and a great many, or a large proportion. This is a story, and I can't vouch for it, and I don't know whether it's true. A proportion of the what I call the professional middle classes who were beginning to grow up in Cyprus were attracted away to Turkey. So the Turkish community was weak in the professional middle classes.
So when you went to Cyprus in 1955, what was the Turkish position politically? What were their aims? Were they content with the status quo?
Yes, I think that puts it right. I think they were fearful, very fearful, that the Ayoka insurrection, as I call it, that we would give in to it and allow innocence to take place. They were fearful of that. But for their own part, they were content, and they wished the status quo, that is to say, the British government, to continue. I think that was quite clear and definite. As time went on, of course, the idea of partition developed.
Was there a Turkish organization to counter Ayoka in the early days, or did this come later?
Well, that came later. No, there wasn't. There was just a political organization. The Turkish leader was a chap called Dr. Kutçuk, and that was an entirely political leadership. There was a mufti, who was the religious head, but he confined himself to the Muslim religious side. And I think that was the general's, the setup was that there was Kuchuk, who was the political head, there was the Mufti, who confined himself to purely religious functions. They were kept in touch with each other. But there was no militant organization at all.
So the Turkish situation was very different then from the Greek,
yes,
was it not?
Yes, very different, yes. Yes, quite different.
Could I now ask you, Lord Harding, having established the various groups in Cyprus, about your journey to Cyprus at the end of 1955? How did you travel out there?
Oh, we flew out. We flew out from London with my wife and George Sinclair and an ADC and a soldier servant whom I had had before, a young rifleman, who was very good. And I remember telling my wife that I didn't know what sort of a reception we got, but if we were met with bombs and banks, and I told her to lie down, she was to lie flat on her face on the ground and stay there until I told her to get up. And I think for once in her life she would have done what I told her. But actually, we flew out, we landed at Nicosia, and were met by the senior officials and members, the then members of the Executive Council. There was still one Greek member of the Executive Council, and with a salute, a gun salute, which my wife thought, first of all, bombs going off, and then was satisfied it was all right. And then we drove to Government House. And whether that day or the next day, I think it was that day, I was sworn in by the Attorney General, or the Chief Justice, I suppose, who did it, I can't remember, as governor, and started to take a look around. And I met both the Colonial Secretary and other of the senior government officials, and started to try and get myself acquainted with the situation. And the chief of police, of course, and the senior soldier, and discussed things with them, and decided that the sooner I got busy on the political front, the better. So I said I wanted to ask Makarios, the Archbishop, to meet me at the earliest possible opportunity. So that was what I call the political part of my job. And then I tried to assess the situation by talking to the chief of police and the senior soldier and the government officials. And I came to the conclusion that the situation was pretty grim, because the police were pretty well completely demoralized. They'd lost a lot of, they'd had a number of casualties, a number of police stations had been raided, and they'd lost arms and ammunition. One or two of the utility organizations, like the electricity and so on, had been attacked but successfully were not damaged, the wireless station and so on. And there was no effective, efficient intelligence organization. Nobody knew anything much about the OCA, except that Rivas was the head of it, and they were actively engaged in attacks on the police. And seemed to me to be no sense of what I call operational urgency or common purpose and effort in the government officials. And so I thought, well, and the army, and after I found out what they were trying to do, seemed to me to be not being employed in the most effective way. They were going in for what I call village bashing, and wiping out signs on the roads and the houses, which wasn't a very effective way of dealing with the situation. So gradually I tried to sum the thing up, and I came to the conclusion that I would have that my primary objective would be to get control of the main centres of the population under government control and the communications between them. That was the first requirement, and to make sure all of the essential services were maintained, electricity, water, communications, and so on. So that was my object. I came to the conclusion that I would have to do and have to set up or start a proper intelligence organization. I would need more troops, and for the time being, at any rate, I would have to use the troops for what I call police duties, particularly in dealing with riots and so on in the towns, and particularly in Nicosia, where there had been riots and disturbances, and the British offices of the British Council had been burnt down and so on, and the police were unable to deal with such situations. So we had to arrange, make up my mind that other than the usual use of troops in support of the civil authority and of the police, they had to be trained to act as policemen in certain circumstances, and particularly in the main towns. So those were the jobs.
Could I ask you about the composition of the police force? You know, would they have been Greeks or Turks?
Well, they were mixed. They were recruited from the population as a whole. The majority were Greek. And of course, they had been put under very severe pressure. Some of the senior officers of the police had been put under. The security of the police itself was not all that good. So there was a lot to be done. And then I decided to start negotiations with Machias. And I had a very early, I'm not sure, it wasn't 2 days after I arrived there that I had my first meeting with him. And I explained to him what the British government's policy was, that it was essential for us to have maintain our government over the whole of the island, and that ENSIS couldn't be contemplated for political-strategic reasons, but that His Majesty's government were anxious to proceed progressively with development towards self-government. Well, in total, I had 8 meetings with him, and in different situations arose as we went along, but this went on through that winter, and I can't remember precisely when it was. I came to the conclusion that I couldn't reach agreement within the constraints imposed, the strategic constraints imposed by London. And so I had been back to London and discussed this with them, and got them to modify their position and change from no possibility of self-determination, was the way they put the thing. The application of self-determination to Cyprus would inevitably have led to ENSIS, and that was unacceptable to the British government. And so it was necessary to say, all right, progress to self-government, but no self-determination as regards security, foreign affairs, or defence. And that was the final position that I found myself in. The British government did modify, on my recommendation, modify its position, to the extent of saying, all right, well, not now, but not never. And that was what I, what came to be called the double negative. Self-determination, not now, but not never. And that, but that failed to be acceptable to Makarios. And so after my seventh meeting, I think it was, with him, I came to the conclusion that I that I couldn't.
Was that confusing, do you think, that double negative statement?
Well, it wasn't to me, but I think...
But do you think it perhaps, you know, with language difficulties, it was confusing to...
Well, I don't see why it should have been. I think, I mean, it's perfectly clear that self-determination was not put off forever, but depended on developments and circumstances and change. And I tried to point out to the Archbishop that change would take place because for two reasons. Really, the political lineup in the Eastern Mediterranean would undoubtedly change as things developed in the Middle East. And also, with the increasing range of modern aircraft, the strategic importance of Cyprus, from our point of view, would diminish. But that was not something that would happen in the early future. And for the time being, it was necessary for us to have the use of the whole of the island of Cyprus for military purposes in case of need, because of our obligations under the Anglo-Jordanian Treaty and as members of the Baghdad Pact.
So it would seem to me that if there was any confusion about this double negative, that you did explain to Makarios what the position was. You made it quite clear what the British government meant.
Well, I hope I did. I think so. That was, of course, a modification in the British government's position in the course of my negotiations with various meetings with Makarios. But when, at my seventh meeting, I came to the conclusion that I couldn't reach agreement with Makarios within the constraints imposed by the government in London, and I suggested that the Foreign Secretary should come out and meet him and discuss it. And so we had a meeting. Lennox Boyd and I went together to a meeting with the Archbishop. And it was during the course of that, I think it took place in the Archdeacon's house, the Anglican Archdeacon's house. In fact, I'm sure it did. And there bombs went off during the meeting, and a lot of present-day critics think that the fact that bombs went off were the cause of Lennox Boyd and I deciding that we couldn't reach agreement, that was the cause of it. Actually, there's nothing to do with it at all. The fact that there were bombs going off was incidental and had nothing to do with our decision that it was no good continuing. My point really was that if we couldn't reach agreement on the political side, then there was only one thing for me to do, and that was to concentrate on inflicting a defeat on the Ilka, and to concentrate on that and stop any sort of political activity until that had been achieved. And that policy was accepted by London.
With these negotiations, is this where Noel Baker became involved?
Francis Noel Baker came out. He, as you probably know, his family had property in Greece, and they were very very knowledgeable about Greece and Greeks and his family. His family had definite relationships with Byron. I can't remember what the precise relation it is, but Francis Noel Baker, and back in his family history, there is a connection with Byron. Anyway, they were what I call Greekophiles, but very anxious to do. Francis Noel Baker was he's then a member of Parliament. He was very anxious to do all he could to try and bridge the gap between the position that I was taking up under instructions from London and Macarius's position, but he wasn't successful. And so it was decided to break off negotiations and for me to concentrate on inflicting a defeat on the Ochre. In other words, thinking was that I had to convince Ioka and the people who supported Ioka, which meant 90% of the Greek population, that they couldn't achieve their political objective, that is, self-determination leading to an assist, by violence.
Yes, before I ask you about your strategy in that respect, Lord Hardinge, could I ask you a little more about your meetings with Makarios?
Yes, of course.
When you decided to meet him, was this quite a break, you know, with the previous policy? Was it a big step to actually meet Makarios and negotiate?
I suppose it was, yes. My predecessor had not had any meetings or discussions with Makarios. I don't know, I can't answer for him, because I don't know precisely what his thinking was at the time. But certainly, the majority, I think, of the senior government officials in Cyprus were against direct negotiations with Makarios. But I thought it was the only way, that I had to do that. That was one of my options, and it had to be explored to the limit. And that's what I set out to do. And I had various discussions with interchanges of views with London, of course. And I went back to London, and in order to get this double negative agreed, for example, an acceptance that at some time in the future, unspecified time in the future, the British government in London would not put any obstacles in the way of self-determination.